I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Eve Lazarus joins me again. Her latest book is already a bestseller and has shone a light on one of the more sensational murder cases in Vancouver during the 1960s. It's a case that I was fascinated with when I first read about it at the age of 11 when Chuck Davis's Top Dog, the history of radio station CKNW, was published. Esther Castellani was dying a slow, agonizing death, and the cause was undetermined when she died in 1965. Soon the dots are connected, and her husband, Rennie Castellani, a personality at NW, is suspected of murder. He had been having an affair with a buxom receptionist at the station, and soon he's arrested for murder, and a highly publicized trial ensues. 11-year-old Janine Castellani only has her father left, and believes her father did not kill her mother. In fact, in a second trial for the murder, she testifies as such. Rennie is still sentenced to hang, and that's not where the story ends. Eve has done a wonderful job researching Esther's life, the abuse she suffered as a child, as well as Rennie's life, and what happens when he's sentenced to imprisonment, as the death penalty is soon abolished in Canada. Janine's own life is explored, and in the light of her mother's murder, casting a pall on it, how she's fared and come to believe that her father did kill her mother. Eve does a marvelous job at setting the scene, providing the color of the era in this part of the world. The Vancouver of 55 years ago changes quickly, and Eve places a lot of what happens in context with today. The full title of the book is Murder by Milkshake, an astonishing true story of adultery, arsenic, and a charismatic killer. It is Eve Lazarus's sixth book. Her previous titles are Blood, Sweat, and Fear, Cold Case Vancouver, Sensational Vancouver, Sensational Victoria, and At Home with History, which she was first on this program with back in 2007. She is a member of what's affectionately called the Belshaw Gang, a terrific group of historians and writers who've done tremendous work chronicling Vancouver's history, who published Vancouver Confidential some years ago. Eve Lazarus is a journalist, crime historian, and a best-selling author. Her website is at evelazarus.com. This new book is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Eve Lazarus. Ms. Lazarus, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you again. And as I was going through the files, I just mentioned, you were first on the show 2007.
I can't believe that. That was so long ago.
Yeah.
11 years.
Yeah. And so you were a journalist for a long time, right?
I was.
Yeah. And that was the first book?
I did a Frommer's guidebook, Frommer's with Kids, back in about 2001. So that was kind of my first one. But this is the first real books.
Yeah. And so in 11 years, you've had six books. A lot of them have been bestsellers. This one is sold remarkably well already, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. It's gone into second printing, which is exciting.
Well, what do you think it is about, I mentioned the Belshaw Gang and the success that a number of you have had with your books. I mean, Vancouver Confidential was a huge hit when that came out. What do you make of the appetite that people in this part of the world especially have about their history?
Well, I think in our case it's been history and true crime, part history, part true crime, and it's scratching this underbelly of Vancouver. And I think, you know, well, at least when I first came to Vancouver, it was all very much history was pioneers and streets named after old white men and
the fire.
Forestry and stuff like that. Yeah. It wasn't all that exciting. It never really excited me. And when I started At Home with History, it was this idea that a house had a social history or a genealogy like a person. And I didn't realise when I was going into that I'd be sort of scraping Vancouver's underbelly and finding out all these really cool stories about bootleggers and brothels and corruption and things that really made Vancouver quite interesting to me. And then with the unsolved murders and so forth, and then connecting with people like John Belshaw and Aaron Chapman and Jesse Donaldson and all that crowd that were also doing the same thing, but not necessarily in journalism or book form. Yeah. We were doing blogs and music and painting, but it was all this theme. And I think people have got a huge appetite to learn about that.
Yeah, and it, especially since the city is changing so quickly. The region is changing so quickly. I think it's important to look back because in 11 years, this neighborhood's changed. I know that in a couple of your books, you do write about places in this neighbourhood, right?
I do, especially with At Home with History and Sensational Vancouver. That was very much looking at houses that still exist. And I've almost been frightened to go back and see, you know, if they're still there or not, because I suspect that most of them won't be.
So as I was telling you before we started, Murder by Milkshake, it's a riveting read. I finished it rather quickly because I wanted to know how it ended, if you will. I mean, I know of the case, and I've known of the case for years. But this book, unlike everything else I've read, talks about Esther's life and the beginning of her life and what sort of childhood was like. And I guess that's important, especially when, I mean, she was the victim of a murder. We need to know about her, don't we?
Well, it was important to me. It was crucial to me, actually, to give Esther a voice in this, because I really felt that she'd been silenced. And I really felt that Rena Castellani was such this huge, larger-than-life, dynamic, bizarre character that everything became about him. And I wanted to shift that. And really the reason why I wrote the book was meeting Janine, the daughter, who was 11 when, you know, father murdered a mother. And I wanted to tell it from her point of view and as much as possible look at 11-year-old Janine telling me about her mother and just who she was and what happened.
It wasn't a pleasant childhood for Esther, was it? I mean, there was abuse at the hands of her stepfather, who I guess she didn't even know that was her stepfather, right?
She never knew.
Yeah.
She died thinking that was her biological father. It didn't come out until the trial that it was her stepfather. But, yeah, there was horrific abuse, sexual and physical abuse in the family and growing up.
And so where and when did she and Rennie meet?
They were 21, and as far as I know, it was some kind of church function. They were both Catholic. They both went to Catholic schools, and it was either kind of a church bingo or a fete or something like that. But they were 21 when they met and got married quite soon afterwards.
And he was friends with, was it Frank Iachi?
Yes.
And for people listening to us, that name, we might know that name from Vancouver history, right?
Well, I didn't, and I found that fascinating. There were so many strings to pull in the book, and that was one of them. The Iacis, it turned out, were cousins to the Filipponis, and who owned the penthouse. And the Iacis had two houses across the road on Seymour. And during the Depression, Eva Iacy turned her house into a bootlegging joint. And she got worried at some point because all these people were drinking and not eating. Mm-hmm. So she started making pasta and big Italian meals. And this place just turned into this amazing restaurant, apparently. And it was after hours club, and celebrities would go and play at the Cave or the Palomar. And then they'd drop by for a plate of spaghetti in this house. And so, yeah, that was a really interesting sort of underground story that I didn't know before I started this book.
He and Frank, did they go into business with each other? Because they ended up having a hotel in Campbell River. I guess he inherited part of it too, didn't he?
Well, Joe Iacy, who owned one of the houses, was Frank's uncle. And he went into a syndicate buying the Willows Hotel in Campbell River in the 40s and then died about 1961. He was still quite young. He had leukemia. Mm. And then Frank and Rennie went up to manage the hotel for his wife and stayed up there for probably about a year and a half until it burnt down, killing four people with it.
Did Rennie have lose any money because of that?
No, he was never invested into it. He was an employee.
Because it comes out later that he tells someone, I guess, that he had paid off some of the victims, and that's why he was short of money, right?
No, I don't remember that. Sorry,
I thought that was in your when he was applying for the mortgage with Lolly.
Oh, no, he just said he was so traumatized.
Oh, I see, okay. That he couldn't work for an expected
return. Which wasn't true, actually, if they'd checked that out.
Was the fire at Campbell River, when the Willows goes up in flames? Because there's a weird moment after that where he does a painting of the hotel on fire.
Yeah.
Is that, I hate to play armchair psychologist or try to diagnose someone. But is that where he, where you as a researcher looking at his life can see where he starts to go off the rails, say?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. I had a lot of questions like that in several parts of the book. I just couldn't explain it. And I got in contact with Heather Burke, who's a forensic psychologist, and she read over the first draft and was able to sort of analyse him and through all the court proceedings and his testimony and things like that. And he basically ticked off every box on the psychopath checklist. He was charismatic. And, you know, likeable. Everybody liked him, and he was very smart and smartest person in the room kind of thing.
Very quick-witted too, right?
Yeah, maybe too smart, but everyone liked him. And even afterwards, when I talked to people that knew him after he went to jail and got out of jail and started working, I'd say, well, what do you think? And they'd all tell me what a great guy he was and how much fun and how smart. I'd say, well, do you think he did it? Oh, yeah. Mm. So that was a big disconnect for me. But back with the fire, he wasn't in town. I got hold of the inquest because I wanted to see what the official word was, and they declared it not arson. There was nothing to really trace him back to it, you know, if he paid someone to do it. It didn't really make sense.
Yeah.
They lost a lot of money, but he didn't. And he'd drove, Janine remembers him driving home in one of the guys that died car and bringing back things. So he was more an opportunist.
Yeah.
I don't think he had, well, who knows? But the painting was interesting. And when Heather Burke heard about that, she said it's such an odd way to express grief. It's almost made her wonder if she had, you know, if he had something to do with it.
And was that one of the first instances that you saw where sort of psychopathic behavior comes up with his life? I mean, was he fooling around on Esther at the time even? Did you get a sense of that?
Not at that point,
yeah.
No. It seemed to be a fairly happy marriage for 19 years until he met Lolly.
And so he meets Lolly. She's a receptionist at NW. And he, I guess after Campbell River, he ends up going into it because he knew Jack Cullen. Is that right?
Right. He came back after the Willows burnt down, and he was always doing things with Jack Cullen's show. I got some tapes from the early 60s through Colleen Hardwick, and he's doing this band with Frank Iasi, who apparently on this tape named the Owl Prowl, which I thought was really interesting. And so it was Frank Iasi, not Jack Cullen. And then Jack, the three of them are chatting about that. And this would have been about 1961. And he'd do these weird skits. He was Clay 2 well, from out of space.
Yeah.
He would come in his spaceship and do these crazy laughs and weird stuff. And yeah, Jack Cullen would be, you know, interviewing him or whatever.
Yeah, and then he'd do other characters and certainly in promotions as well at NW. The Maharaj was one, and then the Dizzy Dialer, which a lot of people, I guess, in this town remember from that era. So he's at NW a lot working there, and then he has a job there in promotions, and then he meets Lolly. How soon after meeting her did they say, sort of fall in with one another?
Did they
fall in with one? Like, did they begin the relationship?
Pretty soon afterwards. Yeah. He was a part-time employee, like with Maharaja. Yeah. That was the huge stunt that really got him employed because it got so much attention and was so successful. So then he got a full-time job, and that started with the Dizzy Dialer, and that would have been sort of the full-time job early in 64. And by the summer of 64, they were well entrenched in an affair.
So you got to talk to Janine a lot. She has memories of this time.
Yeah,
obviously, she's in elementary school. What did you get a sense of what her childhood was like with Esther and Rennie as parents?
Really happy, and she remembers a very, very happy childhood. And if you see the photos that are in the book from the album, you know, they're all laughing and just she remembers, you know, really good times with her mother. Her mother worked, she was an assistant manager at Joyce Dayton's in Kerrisdale, and Janine would go there after school. And, you know, she said she really remembers it as being very normal, except they moved a lot. You know, he was always out of jobs or in between jobs, and they would be moving. You know, at one stage they had a house, and that Esther's father had helped them buy, and mm-hmm. he lost that, and they move above a hairdresser's store at Kerrisdale at one point. And so it was a lot of moving around, but she remembers as being quite happy until they met Lolly and they moved into a house, and then they basically were living separately.
And then Esther finds out about the relationship, right?
She does, yeah. Pretty early on, actually. And she found a letter addressed to Reenie in his wallet, and just said, "Love, Lolly."
Yeah.
And Lolly was apparently in Hawaii doing some kind of CKW promotion or helping out. And he'd phoned her, and there was a $60 phone bill. And Esther had confronted him.
Yeah.
And then soon after, she started getting sick.
So what was her health like before that? She was fairly healthy, wasn't she?
She was quite healthy. She never missed a day of work. And so this was completely out of character.
And so what are the symptoms that befell her?
Well, arsenic is very, very clever. If you want to kill someone, it mimics natural causes like virus or gastroenteritis. And that's really what they thought. After she went to hospital, she was there for 7 weeks, and she had over 120 tests done on her mm-hmm. for just about everything except that. They never thought of arsenic. They thought it might be lead because that's in paint and stuff like that. But no one ever occurred to them to test for arsenic until after she died.
That's a funny thing, because Arsenic and Old Lace, that book, that film, I mean, a lot of people watch it. In the book, I think you write that Reenie must have watched it.
Yeah.
And yet they didn't think to test for that. I guess nowadays they do, don't they?
Well, I don't know. Actually, probably not. And when I talked to a toxicologist and asked him that, he said, no, why would they go to that?
Yeah.
It's a special test that they have to send away for, and now it would be more difficult. Like in the 1800s, everyone bumped off their relatives apparently, and they didn't like with arsenic, and you know they brought about an arsenic act in England that it had to be monitored, and you know everyone knew who had bought it. But here in Canada in the 60s, everyone had it under their kitchen sink. It was rat poison. It was weed killer. So it's interesting that they wouldn't have thought of that. But I guess he was acting all the time through the hospital as a loving husband. And, you know, they didn't know about the affair outside that. So it wasn't something that they would think of.
And in the time that she was hospitalized, he had a bit of an alibi in terms of being away from the hospital, in that he was atop the BOMAC sign, which is still there on Broadway. That was an NW promotion.
That's right, yeah. He climbed up to the sign. There was scaffolding put up next to it. And the thing was, I'm going to stay up here until every last car in the lot is sold. And it was quite a wild promotion. He was in a car, apparently, and he would hang out a line of washing with his underwear waving in the wind. And people would drive past and honk their horns and got really into it. And he was up there for 9 days. And during that time, the 9 days, Esther got better during hospital. And just her health started to improve. She got up. And the day after he came down, she crashed.
Yeah.
And when they looked at the when they tested it a couple of months later in Toronto, they could test through a nuclear reactor the amount that was taken in it and roughly a timeline of when it was given. And they figured it was probably...
Because he was back and he was...
Back and she got a big dose sometime in 30 days before she died.
And that's the thing, because they didn't know what her stomach illness was. And she, I guess she didn't have an appetite. The doctor suggested to family that they bring food that she likes. So her mother would bring the beans and beef and try to feed her. And Reenie would bring in... food himself, usually milkshakes, right?
He was seen a couple of times with milkshakes.
Yeah. Milkshakes that I guess she had had.
Well, she loved milkshakes. Yeah. The strange thing with this whole thing, it was all circumstantial evidence. He was never tied to it. The delivery system, when I talked to toxicologists, they said, well, it's a no-brainer. She loved milkshakes, which she did. It's the perfect delivery system for arsenic because you can't taste it and you can't see it. So that would make sense. But it was never proven. And it's interesting, even now, if the case happened today, he may get off.
Yeah. So you in the course of writing this book, you talked to Janine, There's an interview with Gloria, who is Esther's sister. That was an interview done by somebody else, is that right?
Yeah, that was done about 15 years ago through Susan McNichol had written a chapter in her book, BC Murders, and had wanted to do a book and had got quite far in the sense that she'd contacted Janine and she'd interviewed Esther's sister Gloria, who was quite elderly at that point. And ill health prevented her from actually writing the book. And when I talked to her, I said, you know, I just want to make sure that you're not going to do it. I don't want to step on your toes. And she said no. And she handed over all the tapes and everything, which was incredibly generous for a writer to do that.
Yeah. And so when you hear the tapes, so there were tapes that you could hear.
Yeah.
Does Janine say that she was like Esther at all in terms of how they sounded even?
Gloria?
Yeah.
She was very different, and it turned out that she was a half-sister. She was 5 years younger. She was very beautiful, and she had huge problems, and probably because of the abusive background. Yeah. But she'd married a doctor quite young and lived quite had three daughters and lived quite a, you know, rich lifestyle.
Lived on Drummond Avenue at one point too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And very fancy, but it seemed to always be jealous of Esther, and that's what Janine said. She could never work out why, because it seemed like Gloria had everything and her mother didn't. So that was really, I thought, interesting. And during the trial, they tried to make out that Gloria may have poisoned her sister.
Yeah, and then there was even talk that I don't know if Janine says this on the stand, that she thought that Gloria was after Rennie. Or that they had an affair.
Yeah, the prosecutor, this is Gloria talking on the tapes, and that was fascinating because it never came up in the transcripts or anything. But the prosecutor apparently went after her and said that they'd had an affair, which he denied. But yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah. Does Janine remember when she first met Lolly?
Yes. Her father would take her into CKNW. And it was quite awful, actually. After they were having an affair, and so Lolly's got a son, 5-year-old son. Didn't you always want a little brother? And wouldn't you like to go play secretary with Lolly? And you know, they became sort of buddies.
Yeah.
Even while he's poisoning her mother.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the son Don in a sec, but looking at the timeline. Lolly could very well be alive today, right?
Yes, she could.
I'm sure in the course of writing this book, you tried to find her.
Yeah, and I couldn't find an obituary, so I suspect that she is alive. She's estranged from her son and has been for over 10 years. I couldn't find her, which was... It's probably the thing that bothered me the most about the book, because I suspect she was a victim along with everybody else, but I just don't know. I mean, she was a 25-year-old widow with a 5-year-old son, and she actually got fired over the affair, and he kept his job because his wife was sick. Yeah. So, and then she looked after Janine. She had no financial support.
And this was even after the two trials. How long did she live with Lolly?
Well, after Esther was murdered, they all moved in together. And then he was arrested probably 8 months after that when they took out a marriage license. The police swooped in and arrested him. And she didn't see her father for another 2 years, so she lived with Lolly and Don for that time, changed schools.
Yeah.
And was living with them for almost 5 years in total. It was cut off completely from Esther's side of the family.
Yeah. You can see just how abusive it is for Janine, even... if Rennie is in jail, just how controlling he is of her.
Yes.
And as a result, it does affect her, doesn't it, throughout her early life especially?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it probably started with the trial, you know, the second trial where she was put on the stand, the only defense witness, and coached in what to say. And so 50 years later, I'm reading her out her testimony from the transcripts, and I said, well, is this true? And no, she'd say, I was told to say that, or I was coached to say that, or as, you know, come on, Janine, you remember it this way, don't you? And she said, yeah, I still knew it was wrong and at that time, and you really resented that, and it still does, I think. I think she's still really upset, and she believed her father was innocent until probably into her early 20s, and Yeah, I can't even imagine how difficult that would be to then know that he wasn't, that he murdered a mother.
Yeah, and she rationalizes that in talking to you for the book, in that she needed to sort of cling to him because her mother was dead, and she was worried that she would lose him. Right?
Yeah, and he kept saying, we'll be a family again if you do this. And, she was 13, of course.
Yeah. So you mentioned that she believes him until she's about 20, and that's when their relationship sort of devolves, doesn't it?
Yeah, she met her fiancé, and Renee hated him and threatened them both. And there was also an accident, actually, on the night that he was convicted of murder.
She got hit by
a police car, and there was quite a bit of money coming in when she turned 21, and he wanted a share. He felt he deserved to have a share, and her fiancé said, no, that's enough. Yeah. You're not going to give him any of your money. And threatening letters started, they were quite worried, actually, that he might do something to them or have something done to him. So she cut off all contact.
So that's Janine's fiancé, who eventually becomes her husband, Dale. He says quite pointedly to Janine, your father's bad news, and words to that effect, right?
Yeah, and I think then she started reading, because she'd never read the clippings. She'd been kept away from that. Her friends had sort of, supported her by not telling her, and then she started reading and really looking into it, and then she realised, hey, he murdered my mother in the most horrific way, and then had me, be buddies moving in with this new family. And, the fact that they all went to Disneyland the day after Esther's funeral, it's awful.
It's terrible to think that, they go down in the NW car driving down to and then the... They register, or he introduces Lolly as his sister at one point and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really creepy. So when you have to go over all of this stuff, because it's terribly unpleasant in a lot of places with Janine, 50, 55 years later, she's obviously had a long and hard path in terms of trying to process all of this, and then, of course, family relations that are prevented from say cultivating, and then she eventually gets back with her grandparents, Esther's parents. What does she make of all of this, and someone interested in her parents and especially her mother's murder as you were?
Well, I think she really wanted to tell the story. In fact, she sought me out. She came to my book launch, and which was just bizarre, because it was at the police museum, and we had a cash bar in the autopsy suite, and Esther's true crime exhibit in the morgue right next door, and in all this walks Janine, it was odd.
Yeah.
And then we met the following week with her daughter, and many times after that, and I was intrigued by telling a story from her point of view, and in fact, in the book, the murder is probably the least interesting part to me of all of this. It's all the other things, the 60s and the radio and the prison system, and all of that was just absolutely fascinating to get into.
You mentioned the prison system at one point, because the death penalty is abolished. Rennie is sentenced to life imprisonment, but then he's in one of the prison that he's in. He gets weekend passes, and then he eventually gets a job where he can work at a radio station while serving his time as well, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. So here's this guy. He gets a death penalty commuted 2 weeks before he's due to hang.
Yeah.
Then he gets it commuted to life in prison. So he goes to Masqui, which is kind of a brand-new prison mainly for drug addicts and drug dealers. And he's good behavior, and within a couple of years, he's on day passes and he's working for community services in Abbotsford, and he's playing Santa Claus at Christmas, and he's working on all these promotions, and people love him. The guy that was also with him that was in prison was, a gun runner from South America, and he stole the petty cash, and they revoked their rights for, day parole or whatever it was, and all these letters poured in from all these community groups saying, please let him back, and people just loved this guy. And Janine remembers within a few years he'd get weekend passes and he'd bring a different woman over. It was virtually like this woman would check him out of jail for the weekend, and And then within 10 years, he was fully paroled and working back in radio.
Yeah, there's a, you talked to our mutual friend, George Garrett. George happens to be at the radio station in Abbotsford, which is, I guess, an affiliate of NW. And he thinks he sees a ghost when Rennie comes up and says, "Hey, George, how are you?"
He couldn't believe it.
Yeah. There's a lot of research that you obviously had to do in terms of writing this book. There were two trials. There was an inquest and then various clippings and then a whole list of people that you talked to at the back of the book. How do you work in terms of putting a book like this together? I mean, it takes obviously a lot of time. Is that fun for you, the research part?
Yeah, that's the absolute best part for me. I was lucky because it was a capital murder, so the transcripts were readily available through Ottawa, and the police reports, which normally you don't get to see, and especially with unsolved murders, which I'm working, you don't get any cooperation from the police at all. So that was amazing having that. I had the inquests that I'd got through BC Archives of Esther's trial, or Renee's, Esther's inquest into her death. And so I had their voices, and I had Lolly's testimony, so I could actually hear them, and the doctors, and I could sort of put all that together and give them some life. And I don't know if it would have worked otherwise, if I could have done that. And then just sort of going through and finding things like street photography, that Renee at one point worked with Fonzie, and they were both, doing this early stuff, and the IACs, which we talked about before, and this whole coffee house culture that he was involved
with.
The attic, which I never knew about. Did you?
I had the quilter on. I forget her name now. she had a coffee shop on 4th. I guess Grant Lawrence has written about her in the West Ender. And that was huge in the 60s in terms of it was a place for young people to hang out, different coffee shops throughout.
Yeah, beatniks and stuff like that. There was no alcohol. You'd go and listen to music.
Music and poetry and that sort of stuff. I mean, it's worth looking at in a book, I would think. You mentioned a moment ago when N.W., Bill Hughes, and management at N.W. finds out about the relationship. Lolly is fired.
Yes.
Rennie keeps his job because his wife is sick. You talk a lot about the 60s and what a very different time it was. I mean, it changes rather quickly by the end of the decade. By 68, everything, all hell breaks loose, I guess, in 68. But it really is, up to that point, a very quaint... Vancouver is a very small town, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Small town values. And really, Rennie was convicted because he was having an affair. Mm. Had he not been having an affair, he probably wouldn't have.
Yeah, the it was circumstantial evidence, really.
Everything. Right? Yeah. Everything was circumstantial.
Yeah, I mean, even you think about the arsenic. I mean, it was weed killer found in the place that they had rented.
Yes.
And they couldn't even figure out if it was their weed killer or the previous tenant. Right.
And even so, I don't know whether that was something really stupid that he did, that he just thought it was smarter than anyone else.
Yeah.
And, no CSI programs back then and all of that. Or it was diabolically clever if he thought that, well, maybe if they know it's arsenic, if somehow they find it's arsenic, then I could say, oh, yes, maybe she ingested it while she was killing the weeds or something. Yeah. I don't know.
And you're quite clever in that you asked Janine whether Esther was a gardener. And it turns out, no, she'd never even done anything like that. Or even the neighbors, wouldn't have, done it in their garden, that it eventually got to her. Yeah. You mentioned as well the signs that if that were the case, Janine at the time would have had sort of the same levels of arsenic, right?
Exactly, or at least showing much more than she was. And that was the issue as well. I mean, no one else had access to Esther for that length of time. One thing I found interesting when I talked to Heather Burke about this as a forensic psychologist, she seems to think that he wasn't trying to kill her at first. She was just trying to make her ill so she wouldn't nag him when he went off to see Lolly.
Yeah.
And he got emboldened as he went on and literally had this doctor couldn't find anything. And it was so condescending too. She'd go to this doctor and he'd say, well, you're a bit plump. So maybe if we put you on a diet and, you know, you change your eating habits, well, here's an antacid and off you go. It was just really condescending and awful. And here's this woman going through this torturous, you know, agony and being patted on the head and sent off, you know, like, oh, well, how does her husband cope with this? You know, he's so good to her calling me in. And it wasn't until the family got really fed up that they got the specialist, Moscovich, in. And even then, even through that 7 weeks of hospital and all the testing and specialists that brought in, they couldn't figure it out. And you've got to think that Rena at this point must have been feeling pretty, you know, comfortable and pretty arrogant that he'd managed to fool so many people.
Yeah, and then Janine says that too. He's playing a part, isn't he? He's not, even after all these years, she really doesn't know him that much because he was always, and I mean, the most chilling part, not only in your book, but I remember reading this as a kid in Chuck Davis's book, at that second trial and he's found guilty, he addresses the jury. And it's really a performance, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. May God have mercy on your souls. Yeah.
And then you write in the book that jurors wince. and even talk to members of the press as they leave as well, right?
Yeah.
About what that feels like. This book has already sold well, as I mentioned earlier, and across the country too, right?
It is getting some national attention. Yeah, that's great.
Why do you think that this story has resonated so much? I guess people have always been interested in true crime, and here's a case of it that's unsolved, sort of officially, but I mean it has been resolved for a lot of people. In a lot of people's minds as to what happened, right?
I don't think anyone thinks he didn't do it.
I
just think it's such an unbelievable story, and he was such a larger-than-life character that it just seemed... It's funny when I talk to people, it's actually not as well-known as I thought it was. You know, when I do talks and things, I'll say, oh, how many people have heard of this before? And it'll be less than half, maybe 20%, and that surprised me. I thought it was more in this sort of popular culture realm, but it doesn't seem to be. But when people remember it, they remember the milkshake and they remember the BOMAC sign, and they might remember the story, but they know that something happened there. So it has really stuck for half a century.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 36, but I mean, it's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, even. The other thing that I was thinking about as I'm reading your book is this attention that you have for detail. It's extraordinary, and it'll soon become legendary because all of your books have focused on even addresses and where they lived. Then you get a great sense of, you know, where they were in life in terms of where they lived and sort of what social, you know, how much money Rennie was bringing in. And it sort of said what neighborhood they lived in, right?
Well, I think that's fascinating, especially when you think of Kerrisdale was probably more a working class area back then, middle class to, and now, of course, it's exorbitant. But those places are still there, and it was great to sort of walk around and say, well, this is a house they owned. Two blocks later, this is where they lived above the hairdressing. Another two, you know, months later, they were living in this house. So there were four addresses all around, you know, Kerrisdale, the Boulevard, 49th Street, where they lived. So it's interesting to be able to sort of walk there and then think 50 years later, wow, you can really see what was happening. Yeah. And
I remember they lived at one point, Janine, as a child, at Main and 20th, right?
Yes, yeah, that was one of the early ones, yes. Yeah.
So she sought you out to tell her mother's story. You do, in the course of writing this book, tell a lot of Janine's story.
Yes.
And one of the fascinating and lovely parts of the book is, I guess she asks you if you've had any contact with Don, Lolly's son, right?
Yeah, it was really interesting. Well, there were two things that sort of sparked this. I'd written a blog post in 2011. I'd written actually about this story in At Home with History, just through the house where most of the poisoning had taken place in Kerrisdale. So I think that she'd known that I knew the story from that. Then I wrote this blog post in a couple of years later in 2011. And I'd made a mistake. I'd said that Lolly had a daughter. Mm. And then I got an email from Debbie Miller and said, you're wrong. Lolly had a son, it's my husband, Don, and he's been looking for Janine for over 50 years. Mm-hmm. Do you know where she is? And, of course, at that point I didn't. And when I finally met Janine last year and at the police museum, I sort of said to her, oh, by the way, Don has been looking for you. And she got really emotional. She said, oh, my God, I've been looking for him for nearly 50 years. So they'd grown up as brother and sister at this pivotal time in their lives, been wrenched apart, had no idea what happened to each other, they're alive or dead.
Yeah.
She'd changed her name, of course, with marriage. And in fact, she'd changed her name after she left Lollies, as she'd been given the aunt's name and told never to talk about it.
Yeah.
So it was this hidden secret. And Miller, well, there's a million of them, and he'd moved out of Vancouver. So they just didn't know where they were. So one of the great things about this book for me was to bring them both together.
Yeah.
And now, you know, Debbie talks about Janine as her sister-in-law, and they're all at the book launch together, and they do Christmas together, and they're back to this family and through this horrific shared childhood experience.
Did Don, in the time that he was still in touch with Lolly and growing up with her, obviously, did they ever talk about this?
Never. And even his real father that died when he was a baby, when he'd ask about him, well, he'd say, I wish I should never have married him, and that was it.
Yeah.
So it's this hidden secret. It's like, off we go, we're going to move on and forget all this happened.
Yeah. Your blog, I mean, I can't tell you how many times a week I visit that.
Oh, fantastic.
Not only for your writing, but also the comments that people leave behind.
Yes.
Fascinating comments at times. You moderate a Facebook group, Every Place Has a Story. Also, a lot of interesting comments there. People say you shouldn't read the comments, but you get a lot of useful comments, do you?
I get the occasional troll, which gets deleted very quickly.
Mm. But it is fascinating that when you post this stuff, people, I mean, it's like the success of this book and your previous books, people have an interest in it, don't they?
Well, it's interesting because I've got a group called Cold Case Canada, and that sort of came out of Cold Case Vancouver. I needed a way to keep the conversation going because I was getting contacted by the relatives, and they wanted somewhere to express what they were going through and frustration in some cases and just talk about it. And I think that's done that, and I made that a closed group because it just became very intense and very personal at some time, but that's become quite a large group now.
Do you get leads at all in terms of not only book ideas, say, but you know, who to contact, but in terms of, say, sometimes solving matters?
Not so much solving, because I don't see myself in that role.
Sure.
If it sparks someone to contact Crime Stoppers, which I know it has, nothing so far has been brought to court, but I know that two are in their process of doing that. So that's great. I mean, that's how I see my job, bring attention to it.
Yeah.
Maybe talk about, and I always do, I want to talk about the victim and who they were and what sort of person and what it's done to the family, rather than just focus on the murder. And I think that's where the comments come too, because a lot of the family members talking about that was my son or my brother or my mother or my daughter. They have no other outlet. Police are usually not in contact with them. And even sometimes 70 years later, it's still unresolved. And I get a lot of leads through that. I've used Facebook to, for instance, I wanted to find someone that had been in jail with Rennie in the late 60s, early 70s, so I put it out. And I found someone that knew him in jail. He was a 20-year-old kid that had been writing prescriptions in Montreal and was sent to Masqui. And so that was fantastic because he was able to tell me what it was like as an inmate in that time. And same with the coffee culture. I was able to find someone that used to go to the attic, the coffee house, and could talk about what it was like. So, it's been huge that way.
I hate to ask you this because you're out promoting this book. Now, but are you working on something else now?
I'm trying not to, actually. It's been a really full-time job even doing the marketing, which is great, the publicity. I've got an idea, but it's like, you know, those things that pop up and you want to keep belting them down.
Whack-a-mole.
Whack-a-mole, thank you. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm trying to do with these ideas because I'm just not ready to. I get really obsessed when I'm writing, and that's all I do. I get up at 4 in the morning, I work for 12 hours, and I just keep going until it's done.
Yeah.
And I need not to do that for a while.
Well, as a fan of your work, and as I have been for more than 10 years, 11 years since you first came on the show. This is not only another riveting book, but it really is a fine achievement as a writer. And I think you ought to be proud for the success that it's had, both critically and otherwise. Because your skill as a writer is and a researcher and a historian, I mean, it really comes through in this book. So I really appreciate coming in to do this. It's nice to see you again.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great to chat with you again.
And I hope we'll talk again soon. Not too soon, so that you're working too hard to write another book, right?
Well, I'm still doing the blog obsessively every week, so...
Yeah, there you go.
I still keep writing.
Yeah, Murder by Milkshake, an astonishing true story of adultery, arsenic, and a charismatic killer. It's published by Arsenal Pulp Press. It's author Eve Lazarus. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.